the show.
Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of The Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. We are mixing it up a little bit today for the roundtable, and Candace and I will actually be interviewed by Dr. Julie Slattery, one of our psychologists in residence here at Focus on the Family, who is going to throw down the gauntlet at both of us about singleness, and I have to just bare my soul and tell all my sadnesses, so you'll want to be in on that, and Candace will just give her usual brand of fab wisdom. Then we're going to move on to an interview with Glenn Stanton here at Focus on the Family about a series of debates that he does with John Corvino, who is a gay political activist. And that is just a great a chat that I have with Glenn about how he has navigated those waters and how they have actually not only preserved but cultivated a great friendship in the midst of that. And then for the Q&A, I'll be sitting down with Suzanne Hadley to talk about roommates and friends. And should friends be roommates, or should you just leave that up to people you don't know so that if you want, you can pack your bags in the middle of the night and leave? So she will weigh in on that. So here we are with Dr. Julie Slattery.
Candace, you believe that the way many Christian singles approach marriage is not the most effective way, or maybe even the most biblical way. Explain why.
Julie, unfortunately, so many Christian singles have sort of gone with the flow of the culture around them, and they have absorbed, whether they know it or not, a lot of the approaches to dating and trying to get married that they see modeled by their friends, some of whom may not be believers, by television, by movies. And so I do see a trend among Christian singles who in their hearts want to get married, but one, feel maybe a little bit embarrassed about admitting that. It seems like it's okay to say, hey, I want to go out and have a great time this weekend. And so the recreational dating seems laudable. You know, relatives are thrilled to see that, hey, she's got a date. But the desire for marriage is almost a little bit unseemly. It seems like, whoa, you're saying you want to get married? How can you even say that? Because you don't really have a role to play. And so there's this notion that the best a Christian woman can do is pray for a husband. That's really the extent of her involvement.
So you're saying that Christian women feel like they can't say to anyone, my heart's desire is to be married, or that they don't say it often enough, or what?
Well, I used to say it to my journal, and I think that's probably where a lot of the women are. They might confide in their best friend, their closest friend, but I doubt that they're having conversations at, you know, house parties, dinner parties, out and about with their classmates, talking about their dreams for marriage the same way they would talk about what their next career move is or what their next education plan is in terms of going for a master's. Or, you know, you'd say, yeah, I'm going to get my master's and then I'm going to go get a great job. But if you say, and then I'm really going to try to get married and have kids, they're like, what? You know, they're kind of seen as weird or maybe even presumptuous to have that notion.
Well, Lisa, as a single woman, would you agree with that?
Pretty much, yeah. I know when I was in junior high, we had, you know, career day at school, and one of my Mormon friends actually came dressed as a bride, and we just all thought she was a freak. And so I think that for me carried over into high school and then college, where I don't even know what happened in my 20s. Like, literally, I just was encouraged by my family and my friends to go out, get a career, and do what I needed to do to just make life happen. And at some point, marriage was supposed to just happen, and it didn't happen for me, quote unquote. And I felt kind of lost in the system of, you know, it's funny because we talk a lot in Christian circles now about intentionality, but there's not a lot of intentionality put towards marriage. And for me, that was the case. It was, how am I supposed to look towards marriage intentionally when I'm moving from town to town to pursue a career that I think I'm going to be growing in, as well as going from church to church, as well as from not even really being open to marriage or relationships. And there was no one alongside of me to tell me, you know, hey, this is what you may want to consider. This may be a good trajectory for you if you ultimately want to get married, rather than sitting by passively.
Well, part of it is, in our culture, you can pick a career goal or an academic goal and you can meet that goal. It's within your power, if God's given you some intellectual ability and some financial resources, to say, I want to become a nurse, or I want to become a radio host, or whatever it might be. But to say, I want to become a wife, I think the reason we don't necessarily become intentional about that is because it's not all within our power.
Well, I think that's part of it. But I think another element in that equation is that we have lost this idea that God has an idea in mind when each of us is born of who he wants us to become. And so we have grown up hearing, you can be anything you want to be. And I'm not sure that's the right thing to tell a child. I think the better thing is to say, God has an idea for your life, and it's your job to discover who has God made you to be? What does he want you to be? And for most believers, if scripture is to be believed, we are called as part of our vocation to be husbands and wives and mothers and fathers. And so we've lost that sense that God has an idea for my life. And as part of that, we've lost the notion that God wants me to get married. It's like you're not even really allowed to bring God into it in that way, because people would say, oh, how do you know that? How do you know what God's will is in that area? Mm. Maybe so he wants you to be single.
So would you believe that is God's will in everyone's life, that they should be married?
No, certainly not. I mean, we know from Paul that some people are specially gifted for a life of celibate service. The problem is that you have so many young Christians, singles, in the church saying, well, Paul said it's better not to marry, and, oh, I got to run because I've got a date in 5 minutes. You know, Paul wasn't living a life of Paul the Playboy. He wasn't dating around. He wasn't recreational in his relationship with women. He was devoted singularly to his ministry and to furthering the kingdom. And in that job description, if you will, he was able to do so much more because he didn't have the cares of a wife and family. But most of us are not gifted for that kind of singular focus. Most of us long. I mean, if you talk to the young people, they'll say, you know, I really do want to have kids, and I don't want to go the rest of my life without sex, and I would like the companionship of a spouse. And if you have that yearning, the chances are you are called to marry.
It seems like one of the reasons that single women in particular, and maybe also men, are not so explicit about their desire to marry is that it's so deep. That longing is so personal and so private. You know, if I were to say someday I'd like to run a marathon, or someday I'd like to get a master's degree, that might be an aspiration, but it doesn't touch my soul or express who I am quite as deep as that longing to connect with another person. It seems too sacred. Is there a problem with keeping that private and sacred?
I think that there can be, just because there's the feeling of, if I put it out there and for some reason within 5 or 10 years it's not fulfilled, there's an element of rejection to that. Like, I've been rejected by someone or multiple people because I'm not married at that point. And then two, I think there's just the concept of why, you know, I think Christian singles now are in two camps. We've either completely abdicated and become, you know, the cultural norm of literally like Sex in the City, I just need to do what I need to do. Or we kind of over-spiritualize things and it becomes this, God is so in control of the situation that I just need to sit around and wait for the stars to align, and it's going to be this mystical experience that I don't have any control over, and I'm just going to sit with my hands folded. And I know a lot of Christian women fall into that camp. And so there is that element of, I don't want to put my heart out there because, you know, what if it's never claimed?
Now, you had mentioned kind of before we started this conversation, just off mic, Lisa, that your outlook on this has changed over the last 3 or 4 years. How has it changed and why?
Yeah, I think it has.
Because I'm so compelling.
This lady has influenced you, huh?
This water's revolutionized my life single-handedly. No, I think it has. I think in part because of my experience here at Focus and in becoming more familiar with Boundless. I was very much, like I said, you know, on the front end, my 20s were just kind of this wasteland where I wasn't intentional about anything except possibly my career and maybe elements of my faith. And relationally, I just wasn't. And I literally bought into the cultural idea that you just kind of do what you need to do and then things will happen as they happen, and you go on dates, and you know, this is how certain things happen in the movies, and maybe that's some, you know, on some level supposed to happen in my own life. And then I went to a Boundless here, did a kind of a test conference thing with a couple guys from out east, and here they're all of a sudden talking about, no, marriage is actually an honorable pursuit, and women, you need to be open to marriage, and men, you need to be willing to risk and put your cards on the table. And I was like, whoa, feudal. You know, I mean, it just sounded like, you know, we were returning to like something about 300 years ago.
Aprons at the end of the conference.
Exactly. And then all of a sudden I was like, whoa, this is in the Bible, you know? And so it was just like this, you know, not that I didn't think that I knew scripture, but all of a sudden you realize that the biblical, you know, it is the, as Candace said, marriage is the default for most people. And so why don't we teach
that?
So
in that experience, what did you hear God say in your heart?
I heard him say that I was basically needing to drop the whole feminazi kind of mentality that I had about, you know, I think Christian single women have been trained in feminism in some sense to kind of the be all you can be kind of thing. And I think God was telling me, you know, what does it look like to, you know, to be, well, to be a lot of things, to be feminine, to be open to pursuit, to be open to putting yourself out there, to pray boldly for a mate, to look at this as something that is honorable and desirable, and not just, I'm going to do what I can have control over, and then from then on, just, you know, let things happen.
I wasn't as far along the feminist path maybe as you were, Lisa, but I definitely had picked up some of that I am woman, hear me roar, power suit woman. You know, I came from D.C. when Steve first met me. I think he would say he was turned off by my big shoulder pads and bright red lipstick and really short hair. And, you know,
I'm trying to picture that right now.
But I certainly had absorb the notion that you can't do anything other than pray, and that that's the best and most a Christian woman can do when you've completely relinquished your desire for marriage to the Lord and you're no longer looking for it in any form, shape, or manner. Then God's going to magically drop someone in your lap. And so you have to, you know, the more you let it go, the more he'll bring it back to you. And it's almost sort of this cosmic, magic, formulaic thing, like, well, if, like you said, Lisa, if the stars align and it's meant to be, then I'll get married. And I had a mentor in my life who really challenged that and said, no, there are things women can do to help it happen. Now, this isn't things women can do to make it happen. That would be too far in the other direction. But this notion that there was an activity that I could be about that was purposeful, that was intentional, that was God-honoring, and that aligned really well with my Christian discipleship anyway, so that even if I didn't end up married, at least I would become a more mature Christian. That was really empowering to realize that I didn't have to just sit home on Friday nights and be depressed, and frankly, a little bit fearful that I was going to be single the rest of my life, because I certainly didn't think I had the celibate calling like Paul talked about. I didn't want that calling. I wanted to be married and I wanted to have kids. And I thought that was a shameful thing. And really reading scripture, I realized I'm asking for and wanting what God wants me to have.
Early in our conversation, we talked a little bit about the fact that many Christian women feel like they need to be really passive, that they can't boldly articulate their desire to be married, and that they just need to wait for God to do this magical thing. Now, you're suggesting that there are some things you believe that Christian women can and should be doing to, in some ways, prepare the road for marriage?
Right. Well, in the book, I talk about living like you're planning to marry. That we live...
Oh, wait a minute. That's a pretty controversial statement.
Well, we live like we're planning to be lawyers, or we live like we're planning to buy a house, or we live like we're going to get a puppy. I mean, anything you set your mind to do, you have to then align your actions in your life to get you to that goal.
Okay, but before you go on to what that looks like, I think we need to look at that for a minute.
It's only controversial because of the cultural mindset that says marriage is the one thing that's off limits. You can want anything else in your life, but if you want that, if you're going to do anything to get that, if you're going to be intentional about it, you're somehow either denying God his sovereignty, which is sort of, you know, one aspect, or you're just naive.
Well, how about, let me put it this way. If we put anything out there, let's say if it's something like a career, like I'm living to become a psychologist, or if it's something relationally, like I'm living to become a wife, how might that compete with the calling that God has on each of our life? I'm living to be faithful to my Savior.
Well, I think scripturally, part of the faithfulness to God is marriage for most Christians.
Even if I'm not married.
Yes, I think you, obviously right this minute, you're not married, so you're called to be faithful wherever you are today. Mm-hmm. This is not at all to diminish the single season of life. But it's not the fact that your single season is devoted to God in a unique way that's unique to that season does not mean that you should not have an eye toward what's next. So it's like if you were in high school and you were hoping to go to college, of course you've got to study and pass your math test tomorrow, but you're also going to go to the college fair this weekend and start filling out applications. And so you're being faithful in the present with an eye toward the future and being faithful toward that as well.
Do you feel like that's perhaps making an assumption, though, in terms of, okay, I'm single, I'm living with an eye to marriage, but I'm making the assumption that God wants me personally to be married. Can I have that assumption?
I think that The problem is that too many people have come at that from the other angle to say it's not okay to want marriage. Because they think, and they say, if you want marriage too much, marriage will become an idol. Mm-hmm. And they say, God's all you need. And they say, Jesus is the only lover you'll ever need, and he'll meet all your needs. And if you look to a husband to meet your needs, you're going to go down a path of disappointment. And you hear all of this pushback. And yet, I say, go back to the example of Adam. He was in perfect communion with the Father. Mm-hmm. He was in Eden, in the most perfect place on the planet ever. And God said, it was the one thing about creation that God said, it's not good. Everything else was good. Mm-hmm. But when Adam was alone, God said, it's not good for the man to be alone. And so what was God's solution? Eve. God's idea was marriage. And it is still, here's the thing. Too many of us say, okay, you can't focus so much on marriage because marriage becomes an idol. Mm. Paul said it's better to be celibate. But what do most Christian singles then do? They end up in this sort of middle path, this sort of third way of living a lot like the Sex and the City model, hopefully without the sex, mm-hmm. but not even without the sex. I mean, statistically, the rates are the same.
Yeah, I think, I think what happens is we get into this mindset. I'll take it a step further, you know, and just say to women in their 20s, for example, as someone now who is in her 30s, you know, women in your 20s, if you're Christian, you know, wake up and figure out that, you know, you can be losing a season of your life in moving towards marriage that, you know, can be wasted. And I mean, a lot of women that I know would think that that's just crazy. And I've been in churches where pastors and elders and stuff don't want to tell hard things to women, because, or to single people in general, because they don't want us to make us feel bad. You know, no one wants us to feel bad. They just want us to feel comfortable in our singleness and kind of what we're doing. But I think it's true that we're trying to get the best of, you know, all worlds kind of in that. And it can't happen. I mean, you need to move along and you need to work on your career and do all that. But if you're in your 20s, I mean, there's a season when you're in college and you are meeting a lot of eligible men and stuff like that. That is going to diminish as you move out into the workforce and, you know, heaven help, you know, the women that become in, you know, you know, nurses or first grade teachers. They're just going to talk to women all day.
Let me give you an example of a friend of mine and ask you what you'd say to her. She's just a wonderful, godly Christian woman. And I've known her for several years. She's, I think, just about 30 now. And she spent the bulk of her 20s in Guatemala ministering to orphans. And she came back to the States, but she's not necessarily dating anyone seriously. And to some extent, maybe has some questions or regrets of, did I do the right thing? You know, her heart was very much feeling called to Guatemala and serving these little kids, and mm-hmm. God used her greatly. Would you say that she ruined a season of her life?
No, not at all. I would just want to meet her and hug her and thank her. And
I think God should give her a special pass for being in Guatemala. Right.
No, I would say to her, you have lived out your Christian walk so faithfully, and you can pray with confidence and boldness and bring your desire for marriage. I'm assuming she wants to marry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And she's longing for that, and she has longed for that, and she's longed for children. But I think we've got to be really careful, because I totally agree with you that there are some people for whom those early years just fly by, and it's the pursuit of pleasure and it's the pursuit of ambition, and they miss not just marriage, but the relational aspect that God is calling right. them to grow into. But yeah. there are other very faithful men and women who feel called to something unique alongside this longing
for companionship.
That's
right. And the 20s are uniquely a season of life when you really can do those kinds of projects. You have the energy, you have, you know, you're not encumbered with all the
things. You understand that now with having little ones.
Exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh. But I think there are two groups of people we're talking about. One is a group of people who are being passive about it. They're just saying, well, it'll happen if it's meant to be. And then they go about making decisions and living in a certain way that they actually make it harder and less likely that they'll marry. So that's the group of people I would say, stop mimicking the Sex and the City model, get back on track with your faith, be intentional. But to the people who are like your friend, I would say, I want to come around you as a community of believers, and I would encourage you to find a community where you can get mentoring and you can get encouragement, and you can be praying very intentionally and very boldly for a spouse and asking the older women in the church, help me. Mm. Who do you know? Who could you introduce me to? I really want to get married. Let your desire be known, not in an obnoxious way, But just in a very matter-of-fact way, if you were looking for a roommate or a new place to live or thinking of getting a new job, you'd ask for that kind of input. And I think this desire for marriage really needs that kind of communal help and support.
And I think, too, just jumping in, I mean, I don't think we should look at her story as being, I gave these 10 years to the Lord in Guatemala, and that's just putting my life on hold. I mean, obviously now it's part of her story, and we don't know that God wouldn't have introduced her to someone in Guatemala if that were his will. And should, you know, it would have been her responsibility, I feel, were there someone there to be open to relationships there in Guatemala among godly believers just as much as there would be in the States. And I think we compartmentalize too much and say, you know, this is my season of just the Lord and I just have to be out there and, you know.
Right. You don't, too many people, I think, don't take advantage of the opportunities, right? I mean, you hear about people all the time that say, oh, well, we're just friends. You know, it's like, well, wait a minute. He's a great guy. Why? Why don't you look at him a little bit deeper, reassess the men in your life?
Mm-hmm. That brings up another question that I'm sure comes up for you very often. When does that desire for marriage, that longing for marriage, that belief that God wants me to be married, maybe cause me to marry someone who I shouldn't marry? Mm-hmm. And I begin to settle because I say, well, I'm 32 now. I know that season's running out. This is a good friend. He's not somebody that I would really want to consider marrying, but maybe this is it. Maybe this is as good as it's going to get.
Well, I think that's why the community is so key. You have got to have the multitude of witnesses saying this is a good match. Because as much as you want to be married, the last thing you want to do is marry poorly. Whether it's somebody with character flaws or somebody who's not as spiritually mature as you, you know, we talk about being in the same spiritual weight class and really wanting to be with someone with whom you're better for the kingdom than you were by yourself.
Is it better to remain single than to marry and settle?
It depends on what you mean by settling, because I think in our culture, everybody says settling means he wasn't as tall as you, or he was bald, or he was paunchy.
Let's talk about from a relational or spiritual perspective.
From a spiritual perspective, it's better to be single than to marry someone who is not a believer and who doesn't have, who hasn't demonstrated the aptitude for becoming a mature Christian, who's not on the trajectory to become a strong, godly man.
How about if he has that, but I just don't love him? I just don't have that desire to spend the rest of my life
with
him.
Well, then, obviously, I mean, God gave us Song of Solomon for a reason. Mm. Passion is a part of marriage. And without it, I think you can't be one flesh with someone with whom you're repulsed. You know, you got to sit across this person at the breakfast table for the rest of your life. So that's important. But that we make it too much. We make it everything in our culture.
Mm-hmm. And I think attraction can grow and have several friends who are now married as a result of giving guys chances whom they may not have had they just stuck with their movie ideals, you know.
Right. Or the reverse, that you marry someone who's a hottie and only to realize how miserable you are because he doesn't love the Lord.
Mm-hmm. And I want to say, too, just getting back to the whole, you know, settling and stuff like that. There is I think that's where it gets down to really the concept of putting our trust in the Lord in that sense. And do we trust God enough to know that he has his best in mind for us? And I remember, you know, a guy had asked John Piper one time, you know, he flat out just told him, I will not go to my deathbed not having had sex. I just won't. And John Piper was like, well, you know, he kind of said, you know, well, first of all, let's look at our example, Jesus, who was, you know, probably the, you know, best example of a single person, obviously living a life of perfection and whatnot. But the whole idea of you're going to rewrite your story to how you think it should be and in essence ignore what God may or, you know, may have for you in that sense. And do we trust God enough to know that ultimately, you know, he has his best in mind and
we're
doing our part?
Well, and Lisa, wouldn't you want to push back to that guy and say, excuse me, what are you doing to marry well?
I mean,
you want to have sex, find a wife. I mean, obviously this is not a you give me this and I give you that proposition. But I think we complicate things so much. God gave us this very earthy, natural solution to loneliness, and it's marriage. And we too often just don't give it, we don't ascribe to it the sacredness nor the earthiness that God intended it to have. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's because we have our own ideas and ideals that we get desperate about things and that we start getting into this mode of, I know someone else, a friend of mine who has one of his very good friends now, I think is in her 40s, and she's decided to marry an unbeliever because she has not found anyone else. And I said, well, you know what? Ask her. I said, ask her if she's willing to spend eternity without this guy in order to get these 20 or 30 years. And he did. And she said, I'll settle for the 20 or 30 years. Mm. And it's sad. I'm in the studio with Glenn Stanton. Glenn, welcome.
Thank you, Lisa. Hi. It's good to be with you.
Yeah. Well, for those of you who are familiar with Focus and the goings-on here, Glenn is actually one of our family researchers and an expert in issues involving marriage and some parenting, family trends, and especially you've done a lot of work in the realm of fatherhood as well.
Yeah, so. Exactly. And I'm not an expert, but I play one. On TV.
You do.
Yeah. So.
Well, that's good. That is, we take those folks on the Boundless Show as well. So just really whoever's available between 10 and noon on a Tuesday.
There you go.
So, but anyway, we wanted to talk a little bit. Glenn actually recently authored an article that appeared in the January issue of Christianity Today.
Mm-hmm.
And related to kind of a relationship that he has with a friend of his, John Corbino.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
John is actually a gay man and is very involved in gay politics. And when Glenn, was it, you guys have kind of started, and this is what really the subject of the article is about, how the two of you have taken kind of your stories on tour in the sense of debating publicly on college campuses the issue of same-sex marriage.
Yeah, yeah. John and I met through debating the issue of same-sex marriage. And probably the first time that we debated was up in Michigan, close to where he lives, probably about 6 years ago. And I liked John. And I liked John primarily because he took the issue seriously. He didn't take cheap shots. I mean, if I had a nickel for every time somebody called me hateful or bigot in a debate. But John doesn't do that because John takes the issue more seriously. And what is interesting about it is we have debated over the years and we debate quite regularly and enjoy debating because we both respect how each other takes the issue and we both respect each other. And that allows us to really go after each other in a more substantive, spirited way. And we really want to demonstrate to students that, you know what, you don't have to get along to respect each other. In fact, some of the best respect can be based on differences. And so we want to demonstrate to students that democracy demands spirited, engaged, long-term debate, especially important issues like same-sex marriage, abortion, I mean, all these different things. But very seldom do people on various sides really engage each other for any sort of long period of time. And that's a shame.
Mm-hmm. Now, you guys obviously have had the chance to grow your acquaintance with one another, but would you say that would John know a lot of evangelical Christians necessarily, and kind of
No, he doesn't. Okay. He doesn't. And he's very open to the relationship. But he doesn't. He doesn't know a whole lot of Christians. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because both of us will sort of introduce each other to what we call our folks, people that we think that they would respect and appreciate. It was interesting. Just last week, CBN News, Christian Broadcasting Network, came and followed John and I. And I was a little anxious about the Christian Reporter and how they would interact with John. But you know what? They did wonderfully. In fact, John said that that was probably the most thoughtful interview that he had ever done, gay or straight, Christian, non-Christian. And that's another interesting point. John is an atheist. And so, I mean, we're very, very different. And I lay that out in the Christianity Today article about how different we are and what different worlds we come from. But that in that we have a genuinely authentic and really cherished relationship. And I value it primarily for the things that he's able to teach me and the things that I'm able to teach him.
Mm-hmm. What would you say kind of for both sides has been the biggest gain for each of you in getting to know one another and in debating one another over time?
It's really knocking down stereotypes. And, mm-hmm. and I mean, he understands that kind of what evangelicals think now better than what he did. The biggest thing is, if I can be honest about this, my own admission and his own admission as to who on our side we don't really care for. Because you tend to think, you know what, on their side, they're all lock stock, all together, all agreeing. And you go, no, I mean, that guy's goofball, actually. Mm-hmm. Really? You think so? Yeah. And you can explain why, even though this particular person may be on your side, why you don't particularly care for what it is they believe, how they articulate it, and the way that they conduct themselves. And so that's been a very interesting thing for John and I, is to be able to talk about that kind of thing. And we also agree to keep those kind of things separate, you know, mm-hmm. that we, you know, both have responsibilities and things like that. And so we do keep our relationship and the things that we talk about not private, but just we guard them. We guard them carefully, and you've got to.
Yeah. So, I think there's an underlying element here of it's interesting because in my role in PR, you know, I'll often look at evangelicals on TV, and especially those who are debating or speaking to the, you know, to whether it's gay marriage or some issue where they're going up against a homosexual in a debate, and you know, you kind of have that little pins on needles kind of feeling like, oh no, what are they going to say? You know,
exactly.
What kind of craziness is going to come out? And I think it comes down to, you know, maybe there's an underlying issue of what does it look like for believers to speak the truth in love?
Yeah.
And my mom is funny. You know, my dad died several years ago, and my dad was very much the people person and just, you know, mercy gifts and service and whatnot. And my mom's a little bit more like my personality and kind of direct and whatnot. But she always had the saying that, you know, it was great. She and my dad worked as a team because they were called to speak the truth in love. So she spoke the truth and he added the love. And
that's great.
And so what do you think, you know, as far as Christians who may have, you know, I have several friends who are gay. I have a couple who just got married, actually. And how do you balance, especially in a postmodern culture now, what you say that is truth and how you say that and being hardcore and being very explicit in what we believe and what's biblical, but at the same time, building that relationship. How can it be done well?
Yeah, and that's a great, great question, Lisa, because it's the speaking truth in love. And whenever you emphasize one over the other, either the love or the truth, you have this imbalance. And I think that's very, very important. The first thing that I would say unapologetically is do not see friends outside your community as projects. Do not see them as a mission project. If you do, just hang it up. Nobody wants to be a project. Nobody wants to be a mission. You have got to see them first and foremost as friends, people that you love, people that you enjoy. I am convinced that if Jesus were to come back today, just like when he came before, that one of the ways that most people in the church clearly would not recognize him would not be just that he would hang out with sinners, but that he would clearly enjoy their company. Think about that. He would laugh at their jokes. He would really be comfortable with them. We'd say,
understand,
you know,
their jokes.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, that's exactly right. And that's not to give a green light to just, you know, cast caution to the wind. But there's a real difference between seeing somebody as a mission, seeing somebody as a product, which is really what that's about, or seeing them for who God sees them, and that is his people. And the people that we're trying to reach really have to see that. And I hope that John has seen that in my life, is that I don't have some ulterior motive with him. My desire for John is deep for him to at one point come to Christ. He knows that. But you know what? He knows very clearly that that's not what our relationship is about. So that is very, very key. The other is for people to know, and it's related to that, to have people know your intentions. You know what? If they are asked the question, does this person really care for me? They have to be able to answer yes. And I think that's key. And then in that, that gains you the freedom to be able to speak boldly and confidently into their lives. And John knows. I mean, I never pull my punches. I never mince my words. But I'm honest with John, both in my own shortcomings, both in my shortcomings about the community that I'm a part of, my own shortcomings, the things that I struggle with. And therefore, it allows me to really speak boldly into his life, because he knows I'm just straightforward and I'm not holding much of anything back. And that's key.
Mm-hmm. Do you think one of our biggest challenges in the church, I guess the evangelical church today, is even informing these relationships? I mean, it seems to me I'm on a ministry team at church where we're talking about how we're going to grow our church members to spiritual maturity.
Yeah.
And we're just talking about, you know, what does it look like? Well, like, when do you need to break out, you know, Tim Keller's The Reason for God? And when do you need to have a solid apologetic? But without erring on that side and just building a stack of books. You know, I was like, you know, I think the challenge is let's go out and start building relationships with folks. And then as they ask us questions, don't be afraid to flounder. You know, don't be afraid to just say, oh my goodness, you know.
Yeah. And you know what? That's a good question. And that's something that I'm struggling with. But that's the key thing. I mean, typically we see it as weak when we say, no, just first make friends. No, we have got to just make friends. And we have got to prove to these people, our friends outside our community, that no, we really do care about you. And you don't establish that by telling them. You establish it by showing them. And as Dr. Dobson says, I mean, family life is found in time, spending time. And friendships are found in the time that you spend with other people. And they've got to see you committing your time, giving your time to them, rather than just checking in with them every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that's key. I mean, time speaks volumes. It speaks volumes to children. It speaks volumes to our loved ones and our own families. And it speaks volume to our friends as well. I mean, we care about that which we invest time in, and our friends on the other side of the fence, if you will, have to see that.
Sure. Now, John actually came out to Focus for a visit, and you were unable to be here, but I was able to meet him and do lunch and had a great time getting to know him a little bit. And it was funny. There was a funny incident. We actually passed by our front desk at Focus, and there was a sign, and we often, like when groups come, we welcome people.
Uh-huh.
And the sign that day, I noticed, I
looked
at it.
This.
And it said, Focus on the Family welcomes John Corvino and the Bible Babes. And apparently the Bible Babes are like a group from Southern California or whatever. And actually, I'm the one that pointed it out. And I said, John, I said, get your camera because I am taking your photo in front of the sign because this is the craziest thing ever.
Uh-huh.
And it's just hilarious. Yeah. And he just got a kick out of that. And I know he put it up on his blog and stuff. And I think it does help, you know, don't you think, for Christians to be able to be kind of self-deprecating in the sense of, you know.
That's one of the best things. And I knew, I mean, you're right, Lisa, I couldn't be there that day, unfortunately, but I knew and I trusted that John was going to be in fantastic hands. Even it may be a little bit better for me not to be there because John would think, oh, well, you know, of course they're this way because Glenn's this way. No, they got to see you guys as real human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And that was wonderful. And I mean, what John took away from that was a lot of benefits, but one of them is like when he's with his community and they're going, oh, Focus on the Family, those hateful people. He goes, you know, we don't agree with them. I don't agree with them, but we can't call them hateful.
Mm-hmm.
We may call them delusional, but they're not hateful.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good. And that's one of the things that John saw. One of the other things that he saw when he was here was, you know what? The whole place here is not committed to foiling the gay agenda, if you will. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a lot of cool stuff that we do here. And he saw that and he was very, very impressed with that. So I was thankful that he could come and really be received very, very well by my friends and colleagues here. And that's exactly what happened.
Hmm. What's the biggest thing you've learned from him?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't have an immediate answer. I think probably the biggest thing that I've learned from him is not so much from John personally, but from this relationship, is learning how to relate and how to be respectful, and learning what is insulting and what's not insulting. And I will insult John from time to time, mindlessly, because of things that I'll say and not being aware of it and realizing that I don't think it's insulting, but he'll explain to me how it is. And that helps me. Mm-hmm. That helps me because I want to be honoring to him. But again, that doesn't keep me from stating very clearly what I think. And John chides me about that. He, you know, because sometimes I'll take heat from people like I'm compromising. And John goes, if they only knew how hard you ride me sometimes mm-hmm. in terms of beliefs and what you think, you know, they would be shocked. But it's in that closeness, in that relationship where that sort of stuff can really come out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what would you say, you know, it reminds me of when you were just talking about how, yeah, how do we say things in a winsome way? I think it's helpful, too. When I lived in D.C., I had many friends. I remember one of my friends, Sue Ann, was a kind of a new ager, mm-hmm. in a sense. And mm-hmm. we had a conversation once where she said, okay, Lisa, so are you telling me that if I'm a good person and I'm really seeking the truth and I'm trying to, you know, live my life sacrificially for the good of others.
Yeah.
And I'm open to ideas and open to faiths, but I don't find that answer in Jesus Christ alone, uh-huh. that I'm going to hell.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought for a minute and I said, well, if I understand you correctly, yes, I'm saying that you're going to hell.
Uh-huh.
However, let's just go grab some coffee and, you know, continue the conversation. And she was still my friend. It was all within the context of friendship. Mm-hmm. So we could establish that. And then what you can do is backfill with love and with understanding them as people and who, you know, why she believed what she believed and to listen and to keep the dialogue open. I mean, that was huge for the two of us, I know. And it's quite a challenge. So if you could sit down, if there was one thing that in a conversation or in a debate or whatever that mm-hmm. you could get John to understand and change his mind on, what would that be?
That's a good question. And I have a quick answer on that, an immediate answer. And it would be the reality of God and the grace of God.
Mm-hmm.
John was raised a Catholic. He studied to go into the priesthood and through college and graduate school, really chunked all that. But I know in John that seed is still there. And even beyond the same-sex marriage issue and things like that, I mean, what I would really want John to understand is the phenomenal grace of God.
Hmm.
And the flagrant grace of God, really, that I've experienced and that John can experience. And I think, I mean, I would say this to John directly, that without God, it's funny because people say God is a covering for everything. I think people without God are covering. And John covers pretty doggone well in the sense of he is, for all intents and purposes, a pretty healthy individual from a number of angles. But I can see it. And I want him, just like that was the prayer for my own father, to not live under the shrouds that we live under and just to accept and experience and live in just the immeasurable grace of God, which I'm constantly learning about every day and just how freeing that is.
Sure. It reminds me of, you know, I don't know if you've seen that YouTube clip of Penn and Teller talking about a guy who came up to him after one of his shows and gave him a Bible. And he had written on the inside of it and basically presented it to him and said, I just want you to have this, and gave him a few words, you know, alongside that. And Penn reflects on this in this just very, you know, poorly produced kind of video where he's videotaping himself. And he says, you know, how much do you have to hate someone to believe that you have the truth and the answer to life's biggest problem mm-hmm. and not be willing to tell them, you know, about it.
Wow.
And so he said, you know, he said, I just give full props to this guy for coming up and flat out telling me, knowing that I'm an atheist. Yeah. And he said, and I think he actually said, I know there is no God.
Yeah.
He said, I know there is no God. But the fact that this man came up because he believes that there is and yeah. was willing to interrupt me and start a conversation and say, this is what I think. And I want to give you this copy of what I believe to be God's
yeah.
word.
Yeah.
And he said, I think that Christians who don't proselytize are just ridiculous and they're just caricatures. He said, if you really believe what you believe, get out there and fight for it and tell people.
And see, the huge point on that is I'm huge in the idea of apologetics mm-hmm. and reason. I mean, it's what I do. But you know what, folks? It is not reason at the end of the day mm-hmm. that is going to convince people.
Right.
Very seldom do you find somebody that says, I came to Christ because I was intellectually checkmated. Hmm. You know, it's like this story. You know what? They saw something in somebody. It's interesting if you look at C.S. Lewis, I mean, my goodness, the most logical guy. When he talks about becoming a Christian and becoming a theist, it is a completely irrational process mm-hmm. that he went through. Mm-hmm. He can't tell you how he got there. He says, you know, my brother and I were riding on his motorcycle to the zoo. When I left, I was an atheist. When I got there, I was a theist. Mm-hmm. I love the way he tells that story because what he's telling is, you know what, it's the relational part of God. It's something that touched my heart rather than touched my brain. And that is very important for us to understand, especially in this incident, that probably with John, it's not going to be some cleverly turned phrase or some irrefutable logic that I offer John. It's going to be the nature of our relationship. And him seeing my relationship with God and my relationship with others, that's really going to have the impact. And that's important for people to know.
Right, yeah. It reminds me of I worked out with a trainer for a little over a year here in town, and I actually found him. I just did a Google search and was redirected to his site through actually a gay website. And so
wow.
he's gay.
Uh-huh.
So worked out with him. And in one of our first sessions, I told him I worked here at Focus. And uh-huh. He was like, whoa, you know, now she's just going to dump me, basically, because she works at Focus, and she's going to hate the fact that I'm gay. And we actually had several conversations because he'd grown up in somewhat of a Christian tradition. And he kept, you could tell that he always thought that the issue between us was that he was gay. And so
right.
we had this conversation. And I'm like, no, I said, really? I said, the issue between us is that you do not acknowledge Jesus in the same way that I do.
Mm.
And I said, let's not even get the gay stuff on the table. I mean,
exactly.
who cares? You know, and
exactly.
it's like so many people come after you know, they always want to bring up these smoke screens. It's either
yeah.
going to be about abortion
yep.
or it's going to
yep.
be about Christians
yep.
being haters or the church is full of hypocrites.
Yeah.
Hello, tell us something we don't know, people.
Right.
We're all hypocrites.
Right.
We're all sinners. We're all imperfect. Go to YouTube and check out the Mark Driscoll clip where D.L. Hughley is interviewing him on CNN. It's just awesome. I mean, I use it now as a PR example
huh.
of going on there and in 7 minutes basically cutting through the clutter and talking
yeah.
about Christ as the central, you know, aspect of what we
yeah.
need to deal with. So, but I think Glenn, you're just a great example of doing this in the public square in a way that is winsome and relevant. And it's not that you don't know your stuff. It's not that
mm-hmm.
you're not
mm-hmm.
that you don't have cogent arguments. You do. But the fact that you are friends with John,
mm-hmm.
that you've now, you know, met his partner and are building up that friendship as well. And the fact that you are still continuing the dialogue and being open about that while at
yeah.
the same time, you know, really holding fast to what you believe
mm-hmm.
is biblically
and
true.
And it really is. I mean, my relationship with John, and I'm not shy about this, is really one of the most precious relationships that I have, just in and of itself. And that's, John's a little shocked by that. And
mm-hmm.
it's important for, again, people to know that, you know what, I value you for you. And I treasure you for who you are rather than just you know, seeing you as a project. And that's key, as I've said. So
that's neat. So
yeah.
Well, hopefully you'll tell John to listen to this segment. John, if you're out there, hey, remember meeting me when you were here? So come on out again and we'll do lunch and we'll find another sign to
there you go.
By which to take your photo.
There
we'll
you put, go. Put John loves lunch.
I know.
He's all over lunch.
Exactly. That's good. So, well, thanks, Glenn.
Sure. Thank you.
We will not let it go. We will not let this win. Comfort's not the answer, nor the absence of a war. We've carried chains around of our chains.
trend. There's his attention between hope and pain. Chaos means love is on the way. Fall. Don't you run away. Don't you disappear. Fall. Everything is love. Everything is beautiful. The past is not a reason. Throw this all. Breakable if we learn to stand up and believe that we can find a better way. This is the tension between hope and pain. Chaos means love is on the way. Fall. Don't you run away. Don't you.
Opening up today's Inbox, I'm in the studio with Suzanne Hadley. Hey, Suzanne.
Hey, Lisa.
Welcome. And we're going to talk about roommates. Sarah has written us a question, and so let me just kick it off by reading her question. Sarah says, is it a bad idea to be roommates with a close friend? My friend and I are moving to the same city in June. We're currently in medical school together, go to the same Bible study and church, and really enjoy each other's company and fellowship. We pray together on Friday nights and occasionally go to each other's apartment for meals, do laundry, or study. I've heard that close friends should not be roommates, that it could ruin your friendship. Even though we currently get along very well, we also both enjoy our alone time. But I feel like we'd also enjoy having someone to come home to every day and talk to about what we learned or saw. All right, Suzanne, what do you think?
Well, I think it's a really great question. I think we've all heard the roommate horror stories where you think you're moving in with a friend and then they turn out to kind of be a different person.
I've lived them, Suzanne.
Me too. But on the surface level, I think this sounds like it could be a really great blessing. I mean, she's moving to a new city and it will be great to have a friend and someone that she trusts and can confide in. And obviously they get along really well. So I think that it could be a really great situation. The only thing to consider is when you move in with someone, usually it provides more opportunity for conflict. And, you know, suddenly you find out that she's messy and you're not, and you're doing all the housework and, you know, those kinds of things come up.
Yeah. Here's what I found that's like three kinds of crazy. And tell me if you've ever experienced this, Suzanne. I decided after my first roommate experience post-college that I was either going to have to live by myself or multiple roommates, because I had the roommate who every night I became her psychiatric counselor. Mm. And it was all like her issues and all her craziness. And she just vented at me like every night. And so, I mean, how do you balance that? Like, you know, having this close relationship with a person and obviously living with them and bumping elbows and whatnot, but at the same time, not becoming like crazy codependent.
Right. I think that's a great question, because when I was seeing how many things that these ladies have in common, their biggest struggle might be to have their own life. And sometimes conflicts arise that way, because when you do start to have your own life, you see that the other person has other friends. And that can be hurtful,
right,
if they're doing
yeah.
things with their other friends and, you know, you were hoping that you would do things together. So that can be a source of conflict. So I think both people need to be on the same page as far as what their friendship and roommate relationship is going to look like. And I actually had the opposite situation. My roommate right now, I've known her for 8 years, and we used to get together and do a Bible study, and we'd work out and, you know, have fun together. And then when we moved in together, we were so busy that we hardly spend any time together. So we actually had a little roommate sit down a few weeks ago and said, okay, we still want our friendship to continue. Just because we're roommates, sometimes you don't make the effort to spend time together. So it can go the other way, too.
Right. That's true. And I think it is. I have lived with one friend since this time, and she and I were, it really unearthed a lot of potential conflict points for us. And but at the same time, I think that's kind of good because, Sarah, if you intend to at some point get married, I mean, right. Welcome to the real world. This is what you're going to be dealing with. And so it's kind of a good, good preparation for that.
It's great training in conflict resolution because, I mean, you're hoping probably to marry your best friend and things are going to change and conflicts are going to arise after you get married and you're living together. But I had a great success story. I lived with the same girl all 4 years of college. And the first year we hated each other. And then we became really good friends. We were able to really work out our conflicts. And by the fourth year, it was super great. So I would say don't fear becoming roommates with your friend. Just be aware that things might come up and change and be willing to work through things.
Exactly. And some of these other life points may change, too. I mean, it looks like you guys are already doing a lot together. So maybe, intentionally seeking out a few things where you will broaden your sphere of, contacts and friendships and stuff might be helpful as well. And hopefully you have mentors in your lives who will help you kind of branch out and grow a little bit on that same line. So, well, thank you, Suzanne, for weighing in on that. All right. As always, we want to hear from you at editor@boundless.org. We want to get your questions and your comments and any feedback that you have on these shows and what's kind of playing out, the guests that we have, the topics we cover. So please do write to us. We want this to be a conversation. As us postmodern younger generation, Gen X, Y, Z, and other alphabet letters that don't exist yet are. So we want to hear from you. Until next time, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org, focused on the family.